Call Senate Finance Committee meeting, afternoon meeting to order. Today's March 18th. Present are Chairman Stedman, Senator Keel, Senator Merrick, Senator Kaufman, Senator Cronk, and myself, Senator Hoffman. Senator Olson is on other state business at this time. Today we have two items on our agenda. First being the three-year outlook for the POMV modeling as it relates to Senate Bill 274. And the second item is school construction and major maintenance considerations. I invite Alexi Painter, the director, and Connor Bell, the economist and fiscal analyst with the legislative finance, to the table to give us the presentation. Please identify yourselves for the record and proceed with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Alexi Painter, director of the Legislative Finance Division.
For the record, Connor Bell, fiscal analyst, Legislative Finance Division.
And so I'll be kicking off the first few slides on the fiscal summary three-year outlook, talking about funding obligations and needs, and then I'll turn it over to Mr. Bell for the modeling portion. So the first slide is a kind of choose-your-own-adventure version of the supplemental budget. So at the top here, we have the revenue forecast from the fall and then the additional amount in the spring, and then carry forward. So the projected revenue based on the spring forecast is about $6.5 billion total. The FY26 management plan, so that's the budgets that was the appropriations bills enacted last session, total just over $6 billion. So that leaves, based on the forecast, a surplus before supplementals of $492.7 million. So House Bill 289, as it passed the Senate, had $373.5 million of unrestricted general fund appropriations. And from there, we have kind of two paths we could go. One would be if that CBR vote had been adopted. And then that, under the language in the Senate version, that would have drawn an amount equal to the appropriations in the bill. There's additional supplemental items that were not incorporated in the Senate version of House Bill 289. So there were 75.8 million of items that were in the bill but then removed in the full Senate, that were in the Senate finance version but were removed in the full Senate. And then there was also $11.6 million of new supplemental items that were proposed by the governor on March 13th that were not in any version of that bill yet. So that's $87.5 million of items that were not incorporated in the Senate version. And so based on if the CBR vote had passed, there would be a surplus in the CBR that would lapse if unspent back to the CBR. In addition, last year's operating budget had a provision that said that revenue received in FY26 that exceeded $6.3 billion after every appropriation has been made would lapse to the SBR up to $700 million. And so the amount that came in from the CBR doesn't count for that because that CBR transfer is not new revenue. It's transfer in. But the additional revenue over $6.3 billion that's unspent would be transferred to the CBR in the amount of $191.9 million. On the alternative path, if the CBR vote is not passed, so there's that still the additional items that were the $87.5 million that are not incorporated, so that's a total of $460.9 million. If those were all funded from the general fund, that would leave a surplus that would be transferred to the SBR if unspent of $31.8 million based on the spring forecast. A few items to consider with that is that there's still some outstanding supplementals that are potential that we have not gotten yet. Stemming from FY24's performance on the SNAP program, there's a pending penalty of $4.6 million. That's in the appeal process. It has not come across in governor's amendments yet, but that is still an item that's out there. That could eat into that surplus. Another item that could eat into it is that the K-12 estimate in last year's bill, it was an estimated amount to be. The Department of Education has said that they're going to finalize that amount by the end of this month, but that they expect it to be somewhere between $11 and $16 million higher. I think we're we're fairly confident it'll be on the lower end of that based on their numbers, but that it'll be a bit higher than the estimate in the bill. And so since we were using for the management plan number, that's using the estimate in the bill, and this is higher, that'll eat into the surplus automatically. Similarly, the K-12 disparity test we failed. We're undergoing an appeal process for that. If that appeal is unsuccessful, then that would cost an additional $71.9 million. And again, that just increased that management plan number, and that would exceed that $31.8 million projected surplus. I'd also just add that, as Mr. Stickle from the Department of Revenue testified, the revenue forecast is extremely uncertain because of the volatility in prices. So $31.8 million is well within sort of our reasonable margin of error for a revenue forecast. There's a lot of things that could go wrong right now. Prices are above the forecast, and if they remain that way, then the surplus would be larger. Things could change very quickly and go the opposite direction. And I guess I'm saying don't get too excited about $31.8 million seeming like a lot of money. There's a lot of ways that that could quickly disappear.
Question on this slide? Please proceed.
Okay, going on to FY27, so the governor's amended budget. And we don't have kind of a traditional fiscal summary because I want to talk more about FY26, but this shows how you get to the governor's amended budget. So the totals are there in the middle, and then the steps to get there in the various amendment packages are on the right. So the governor's amended budget is the most recent round of amendments added $18.2 million for agency operations. But with the added revenue forecast, that reduces the deficit. That ends up with a post-transfer deficit in the governor's budget of $1.16 billion based on the statutory dividend estimate used in his bill. The current statutory dividend estimate is a bit higher, so you could add to that if you were to keep the governor's language for the dividend. but that was down from, I think, the last with the spring forecast or the fall forecast, that was over $1.6 billion, so it is a significant reduction of that deficit. Okay, so slide 5 is an update to a slide we've shown before, just giving some examples of outstanding funding obligations and needs of the state or items that could be considered for a capital budget. So one of these is the PERS and TERS unfunded pension liability. There's a difference in how to fund that between the Retirement Management Board or ARM Board and the governor who is using a different amortization level, but the outstanding pension liability is $7.3 billion. Sometimes you'll see a lower figure given as our unfunded liability because sometimes people net the health care that's overfunded against that, but really they can't be netted because the funds can't be transferred between them. Each has to exist on their own. So that $7.3 billion liability is just that pension liability alone. And the next item, while we have not issued new general obligation bonds in over a decade for new projects, we still have about $1 billion of outstanding general obligation bonds and state-supported debt. There, again, we had a long moratorium on the school debt service, but there's $380 million still outstanding on those existing debt. The state has a deferred maintenance backlog estimated to be about $2.4 billion. There are two lists that the Department of Education has of school major maintenance and construction. We'll talk more about that in the next presentation. But those total $843.9 million. DEC has updated their figure for the Rural Alaska Sanitation Funding need that's funded through the Village Safe Water Program. It's now $2.2 billion, and that's for maintenance of existing projects as well as first-time service. The Alaska Energy Authority has updated their outstanding need for the bulk fuel program to be about $1 billion. They do have a new federal grant of $25 million a year, I think $50 million the first year, but ongoing perhaps $25 million that will go a long way to address that, but obviously $1 billion is quite a bit, and $25 million may not cover that completely. AEA also reports that there's a rural power system upgrade need of about $300 million. There, in addition, Another, while we're on the topic of AEA, the GRIP project, the Grid Resilience and Infrastructure Project, we don't have a new need for funding now, but there's still additional amounts to match the federal grant in $142.3 million that will have to be met in some way by starting next year, not necessarily all by state sources. It could also be borne by local ratepayers in the rail belt that would benefit from that project. But in the past, the state has supplied a portion of that match, so I want to make sure it's still on people's radar just because we don't need money this year. I think next year, FY28, may be one of the bigger years because they'll be actually purchasing materials. And then the last AEA item here is the Renewable Energy Grant Fund list. They have a new list totaling $41.2 million. There's no funding for that in the governor's budget, but they did do a new solicitation this year, and that's what they came out with.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Painter, the deferred maintenance backlog number, is that executive branch and university?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, yes, that's the two combined. And one thing I'd note about that, you know, we're not covering that in greater depth, but I just like to remind people that the university shows a much larger percentage of the backlog than they have percentage of the facilities. So the state, excluding the university, has more facilities value than the university does, but the university shows like twice as large of a maintenance backlog. That's not necessarily because the university facilities are in worse shape. A lot of that is due to the university having more stringent standards for cataloging their deferred maintenance needs. And we saw an example of that with the state a couple of years ago when the Department of Transportation that manages the public building fund that a lot of state office buildings fall into, they went back and analyzed the actual needs for deferred maintenance for those buildings, and the backlog for just those facilities nearly tripled when they analyzed it more rigorously. So I think we may see that if we did that for all state facilities, that you would see a larger backlog than what's on the list. And so really that $2.4 billion might, if anything, it's on the low side, I would say.
Thank you, Senator Keel. Please proceed.
Okay, so the co-chairs of this committee asked to see the three-year outlook with a set of assumptions that I'll go through, and their assumptions, not mine, so they can speak to them, Mr. Chairman. So the starting point is the governor's amended budget, including those amendments that were received last week. But assuming for statewide items that they're funded at the statutory level, that includes community assistance. The governor's only funding is not putting any unrestricted general funds, but you would need unrestricted general funds to get to $30 million, which is the full distribution, and including retirement payments, paying the Armed Board's amount. For the Disaster Relief Fund and Fire Suppression Fund, where there's not a given statutory level, the chairman asked for the five-year average, which was what the legislature appropriated last year. And then the assumption is that agency operations grow with inflation. The assumption is 2.5%, except for Medicaid. The department has a contractor annually do a report that gives a projection for Medicaid going forward. And this year, they project a 4.8% ongoing general fund increase. And that's in line with their recent projection, slightly higher, but the projection, the number this year actually went up a little faster than that. And then Mr. Chairman, you asked for a capital budget assumption of $400 million growing with inflation. The way that math comes out too is the federal match in the governor's budget is $128 million. If you take 1% of state facilities value, that's including the university, that's $146 million because that total amount is $14.6 billion. And then 1% of school facilities value, that's $126 million. That happens to equate to exactly $400 million, which makes a nice round number. But that's how you get there, is sort of meeting 1%. Generally, with facility upkeep, you want to do at least 2 to 3%, but that does not, the 1% doesn't necessarily include ongoing maintenance, so just the renewal portion. Ongoing maintenance is met in the operating budget. We don't really have great data to know whether we're meeting the 1%, but right now for that amount, but That was the assumption here is just 1%, which would be more than we're doing right now. In the operating side, the Mr. Chairman, you asked to see to assume that the Marine Highway federal grant, the operating portion is assumed to end next year. The transportation bill on the federal side is up for renewal this year. Our federal delegation has indicated that it's, while they're trying to keep that grant going, it's unlikely that the operating portion will continue. It may, but it's less likely than continuing capital funds. And this year we're counting on $83.3 million of federal funding, so the assumption is that in FY28 that will have to be switched to UGF. One thing that's sometimes been included in these sort of presentations but is not included here is that the SNAP program, there's a benefits match portion that is on the horizon, but the amount and timing of that is uncertain. It could be in FY28, but there's an ability to get waivers to push that out to FY31, and the actual amount may vary depending on our SNAP performance. It could be up to $46.2 million, but again, the amount and timing is variable, so that's not included here. Then finally, the chairman, Mr. Chairman, you asked for a $1,000 dividend, which matches last year's budget.
Questions? As you can see, with these very conservative assumptions, we go into the red starting in FY28. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Two other questions. It says agency operations grow with inflation. How about K-12 school funding? And the other would be, is there any allowance here for implementing the salary study, which suggested we were $85 to $160 million short?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, so the K-12 would be included in the items that grow with inflation, but there was nothing specific for that. And then there is nothing specific for the salary study in these assumptions.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Keel. Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. Just wondering the lease sales. We just had a fairly successful lease sale, if you could just mention that a little bit more.
Through the chair, Senator Kaufman, so we were actually just discussing that on our way here, Mr. Bell and I were, that the lease sale for the NPRA, that money would be split between the state and the federal government. Based on the legal interpretation we have from our legislative legal, that money first would go towards grants to the impacted communities. And then after that would be any amount that's left after that could be subject to appropriation. By statute, any amount that is not granted out to those communities first goes to up to 25% of the total would go to the permanent fund, and then to the up to 0.5% to the public school trust fund. Then the statutes indicate that anything remaining would go to the power cost equalization fund. And that's how the governor treats those funds in his budget this year. He does not have the grant, the capital grant, in his budget, but the remaining amounts go to those places. And so they don't actually impact our deficit situation, even in the governor's budget that doesn't have those grants, while the additional revenue would help the value of the permanent fund. And so in our modeling, you know, if we showed no grants going forward, as the governor's budget has, they would help the permanent fund. Our modeling has assumed that none of them go to the permanent fund based on legal's interpretation that the funding should first go to the local communities.
Senator Kaufman. Thank you, Senator Kaufman. Please proceed.
Okay, so this next slide shows just the next few years, and these numbers should match up pretty closely to the longer-term modeling that Mr. Bell will do, but this kind of zeroes in on just the next 3 years. So it shows FY26 for reference, and then FY27, 28, and 29. And so with these assumptions that, you know, not really any operating budget growth, but a larger capital budget than last year. In FY27, that leaves after you account for a placeholder for supplementals of $50 million, that line 14, you can see that leaves a surplus of $177.6 million. But because the revenue forecast shows that this amount we're getting from an additional revenue now is a bit of a one-time windfall, and prices are projected to go back down to $70 in FY28 or 29, the result would be deficits starting in FY28 of $82.9 million and then in FY29 increasing to $187.7 million, which kind of to reinforce this a bit of what the Department of Revenue testified to this committee a couple of days ago, that this really is a bit of a one-time windfall based on where the markets go. So, you know, if we had done this with the fall forecast, the deficits would be bigger. But even without some of the items Senator Keel was mentioning, you know, additional K-12 funding this year and ongoing, or implementing the salary study, with this $400 million capital budget assumption and the $1,000 dividend assumption, we would have deficits starting in FY28 based on the spring forecast.
Please proceed.
So now we'll turn it over to Mr. Bell to go on the longer-term assumptions.
For the record, Connor Bell, Legislative Finance Division. Slide 8 shows the Senate Finance Committee's budget assumptions with the status quo 5% of market value draw from the permanent fund. The chart on the left shows the bars adding up to the total revenue amounts. The blue bars are the traditional revenue sources, and the green bars are the POMV revenues from the permanent fund. And the dotted line represents the budget before the permanent fund, with the solid black line showing the post-PFD budget. And in years FY28 through 34, we see deficits which are filled with the constitutional budget reserve, which is shown in the graph as the yellow bars. So the deficit is, the maximum amount is the $352 million deficit in FY33, which then decreases and turns to a slight surplus by FY35. The chart on the right shows our budget reserve balances. The yellow bars again represent the constitutional budget reserve and the statutory budget reserve. The statutory budget reserve remains relatively stable or flat in nominal terms. The green bars show the realized portion of the permanent fund earnings reserve account, and we see a increase in FY27 and then a continuing decline into FY35.
Questions on this slide? Please proceed.
Now we'll be showing the same modeling except with SB 274, which adjusts the percent of market value draw rate from the statutory 5% to 4.9% in FY29, and then decreasing gradually to 4.5% in FY33, and then remaining at 4.5% for all future years. Slide 10 shows this, the SB 274 POMV formula, with the budget assumptions that Director Painter outlined earlier. We see, since the draws from the permanent fund are decreased, we see larger deficits with the maximum in FY33 at $828 million, and then gradually decreasing to $440 million in FY35. The ERA balance is somewhat higher. It's actually $2.8 billion higher than in the status quo scenario, but the constitutional budget reserve balance is significantly lower at, I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but roughly $800 million.
Questions on this slide? Please proceed.
Slide 11 shows the long-term impact of SB 274 on the POMV draw amounts. This is a rough illustration extrapolating our data sources. So it's just as an example, these numbers are complete rough estimates. But it shows that with SB 274, since the draw rate is lower, the POMV draws are initially lower than the status quo, since you're drawing 4.5% and FY33 rather than 5%. But because that lower draw rate allows the total permanent fund value to increase at a higher rate, eventually there's an overlap there's a point where the SB 274 draw overtakes the status quo draw, and the 4.5% draw actually becomes greater than the 5% draw. And that happens at roughly FY55 in our rough modeling.
Proceed.
Now moving on to our probabilistic modeling. The prior modeling we showed you was our linear model, which assumes one scenario, which is Department of Revenue's spring forecast. And now we'll be showing a probabilistic model that's centered around Department of Revenue's forecast, but then shows the impact of revenue volatility. The slide says two variables. We're actually allow variation in three variables. First is oil prices, which are centered around DOR's fall forecast, and then in a distribution that's, we use a 34% range above and below for one standard deviation. So it's the path of oil prices takes a bell curve shape, and then for permanent fund investment returns, we use Callan's 7.3% average return assumption and then apply a 12.65% standard deviation. And then finally, we also vary oil production, which is not included on the slide. Department of Revenue provides a low and high production forecast in conjunction with Department of Natural Resources, and we vary our scenarios between the low forecast and high production forecasts provided by those agencies. And the probabilistic models don't look exactly the same as the linear models for various reasons due to using differing assumptions, or that assuming the same price in every year is much different than a volatile price that even comes to the same overall average. And these scenarios assume no ERA overdraws, so the only draws coming out of the permanent fund are the statutory POMV draw. Slide 13 shows the sensitivity analysis or risk analysis with the status quo 5% POMV formula. The chart on the left shows the surplus or deficit by fiscal year. The blue bars represent the median surplus or deficit. The green bars represent the 25th and 75th percentile, meaning that 50% of cases are between the green bars and 50% of cases are outside of those green bars. And then the black lines represent the 10th through 90th percentile of outcomes. So in FY29, we see about a roughly $500 million deficit to $500 million surplus, and that grows over time to a much larger spread in FY33, to about a $1 billion surplus to $1.1 billion deficit. The chart on the right shows the range of the realized balance of the earnings reserve account. 10% of the time, the ERA balance goes to zero in FY32. And again, this assumes no ERA overdraws. We also have an assumption in the modeling that we don't inflation-proof to zero, so if there's an insufficient balance in the earnings reserve account to fund the next year's POMV draw, the inflation proofing is reduced to that amount. In 25% of cases, the ERA is significantly reduced to roughly $2.2 billion. And then in the median case, there's a slight decline in the ERA balance.
Please proceed.
Finally, slide 14 shows the same modeling, but with the SB274 POMV assumptions, again with the POMV rate decreasing to 4.5% by FY33. And we see somewhat larger deficits, again, as matching the modeling, but the chart on the right shows that the median or the 25th percentile ERA balance is significantly higher at $3.4 billion versus $2.2 billion, and we actually see a mild increase over time in the median balance of the earnings reserve account. And then at the 75th and 95th percentile, we see a strong growth in the value of the account.
It looks like a spending cap to me. Further questions of Mr. Bell? Senator Keel?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bell, back on slide 11, your crossover point for when the lower draw limit ends up bringing more dollars is substantially later, I think, than Callan estimated. They had us sometime in the 2040s, 2045, and you're at 2055. Can you help us with the difference here?
Through the chair to Senator Keel, part of that is because this, I'm not familiar exactly with the Callan assumptions. It may be partly because this is phased in over time. And also, Callan generally uses risk modeling, which would lead to a quicker crossover point compared to this linear modeling that I'm showing here.
Senator Keel.
Thanks.
Further questions? Done with our presentation, Mr. Painter?
Mr. Chairman, yes, that is our last slide of this one, and happy to switch over to the other one if there's no other questions.
For the next one. Major maintenance school bond debt reimbursement.
Here it is, never mind.
Chair. I want to make sure you didn't fall asleep.
I was using PowerPoint. Okay.
Technical
hey,
assistance.
Mr. Ernst. Yes. Forgotten how to use PDF. So we phase it out with ADA accessibility issues in legislative finance. All right, Mr. Chairman, so I was asked to do a presentation on school construction and major maintenance, sort of a follow-along to the presentation the committee heard last week from the Department of Education and Early Development, providing some additional considerations for the committee. So the first slide here shows a comparison of the different programs that school construction and major maintenance are funded through. So there's the school bond debt reimbursement program and then the school construction and major maintenance grant funds. There's kind of two different paths districts can go down that are significantly different in a lot of respects. And we'll kind of talk about the basics of how they're different and then how the incentives are different for the districts and for the state. So school bond debt reimbursement, the state cost share is either 40 or 50% depending on whether the project meets all of some statutory space standards. For the school construction grant fund and school major maintenance grant fund, the state cost share is a range of 65% to 98%. So it's 98% for an REAA, regional education attendance area, or a small municipal district, which are the three districts that fall into that category. For the other districts, there's a sliding scale based on the ratio of the property tax value in the district to the average daily membership in the district. Those average daily membership, that calculation has not changed since 1993 when it was put in. So obviously property tax values are higher now than they were in 1993. And so most districts are now at that 65% level, so the kind of highest tier. But there are still some that fall under. And some of those are districts like Galena because they have so many correspondence students. They have a lot of ADM per amount of property in the district because there's not many people who actually live in Galena. But some, it's just because they have relatively low property tax values. The school major maintenance and school construction grant program are open to the REAAs, but school bond debt reimbursement is not because those districts do not have a tax base. They can't take out debt. The state funding model differs quite a bit. So for school bond debt reimbursement, the districts or the municipal governments take out the debt, and then the state share is an annual appropriation of that amount. Whereas for the other two programs, the state share is paid up front. So we provide our match. The districts can actually have already done the project within the last few years, or they plan to do it and they can provide the match. But that state share is up front. When you get the grant award, you get all the state money you're ever going to get. versus the annual reimbursement on the other side. And then the funding amounts there, just for comparison. One of the things I'd note is, you know, that school bond debt reimbursement, the full amount, as I had said in the prior presentation, of outstanding debt is like $380 million, but that's prior debt, prior to the moratorium. This year's amount is $41.6 million. For the school construction grant fund, there's 14 projects on the list. They total $442 million. For the school major maintenance grant fund, there is 103 projects costing $400 million, so a lot more projects, but they're smaller projects than school construction projects. So,
Senator Keel.
Sorry, one quick question. The school construction list, can you remind me, are there any actually new schools for expanded populations on there? Is it all rebuilt?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, currently it's all rebuilt.
Thanks.
Thank you, Senator Keel. Please proceed.
So this next slide shows the projected school debt and REAA fund amounts. So the top here is the existing school debt, assuming nobody ever uses the program again and takes out new debt. So that would have a declining balance as those existing debt service amounts are paid off. After FY36, they drop off. I think by FY39 or so, it's under $1 million. The REAA fund is tied to the actual school debt paid 2 years ago. There's a ratio that is 0.244 times the prior year's school debt divided by the ratio of schools in the regional education attendance areas versus the municipal districts. That's currently, that ratio is, or it's actually the ratio of urban districts. So it's the ratio of schools in the municipal districts over the total amount of schools.
How was that formula drafted?
The chairman, that was a legislative drafting choice. I'm not sure where the 0.244 came from. I haven't looked at the record. And so I think the important thing here is that without new debt, the REAA fund amount would also decline because it's linked to your 2 year prior REAA or a school debt amount. And so that amount starts at $19.6 million, but as that school debt amount goes down, that also declines. Legislative finance historically has had this $7.8 million placeholder for new school debt for the post-moratorium years. That we took the average amount of new school debt that was contracted for the last 10 years before the moratorium and then prorated it to the lower state share under the program post-moratorium. The program reopened in July. No districts took advantage of it in fall elections, but at least one district plans to put school debt on the ballot this spring, so we may start to see new school debt come on. And so if you assume that placeholder, that gradually increases, and you can see the school debt plus the placeholder increases for quite a few years and then reaches a bit of a steady state as the old debt drops off. And the REAA fund, again, dips and then starts to rebound. It never rebounds, the REAA fund amount, to what it was even just a few years ago. It was, I think, $34 million when the moratorium came in. We never get up to that level, assuming the $7.8 million, because of the lower reimbursement level. So it never quite goes back to what it was, but it does rebound in the balance if there's new school debt at that placeholder level. So the REAA fund statute says that the department can spend without further appropriation, and they are to prioritize the school construction list over the school major maintenance list, but can also fund projects on the school major maintenance list from that fund as well. And so if you look at the school construction list, six of the top seven projects are in REAAs. Those REAA projects, and I'm using REAA, I should just say, as an aside, because it's very long to say REAA and school and small municipal school grant fund and all of that. It can be used for both. There are three districts that are small municipal districts. I don't mean to exclude those districts. I'm just trying to use some shorthand to save some syllables. But those projects total $382 million. The top school on the list right now is an REAA project and costs $71.3 million. So under either scenario, it takes about 5 years to save up enough to fund that project, assuming no amount is used for the school construction list. One of the difficulties I think that the Department of Education has is that to get to these very large projects, they have to save up and not do projects for a while, and it's hard to not do the top projects on the school construction list or the school major maintenance list, meaning that nothing happens potentially for a year, and to save up. But you need a lot of years to get to that. And one of the issues there is that the fund can only have $70 million in it at a time per statute that's unobligated. And so the department has to phase projects, because if the top project is more than $70 million, obviously they can't just sit on $70 million, the fund, any amounts would lapse. So the approach they often take is to phase projects. They'll try to do a design phase and fund that, let that go through, and then come back to it. Or if you can phase the project and do the construction phases, they would fund it that way as well. But again, having enough money in the system relies on having new school debt. So if you assume no school debt, the REAA fund would never have enough money to fund those top three projects. The existing school debt would run out before then. Even with the debt placeholder, to get those all the projects on the list from the REAAs would take 17 years. In 17 years, you know, I'm not sure that those existing schools would still be there. And also, I would assume that there are new projects that would come onto the list. So, you know, to be blunt, there's probably just not enough money in the system right now to ever get through that list, even with new debt going through the school debt program. So I'll come back to that again a bit in a minute, but I want to talk about the major maintenance grant program. This is something that came up in the hearing last week. So there's been questions about whether there's parity in the major maintenance grant fund between districts. And so we looked at the FY27 list and compared districts that had that 35% cost share. So those are it's about half of the projects fall into that, and then every district that doesn't have that. So that's both municipal districts that have a lower cost share, meaning that they have generally a lower wealth district because they have lower property tax value, and then those REAAs. And we put those into two categories of 35% cost share and everybody else. And so if you look at overall their point scoring on the system that Department talked about, the non-35% share averaged 140 points. The 35% share districts averaged 138.7 points, so pretty close. And so you might think, well, this is a fair program. These are pretty equal. But if you look at the underlying numbers, there's a difference in how they're getting to those scores. So in those non-35% districts, they are averaging 3.7 more points for the category of emergency situation and 2.2 more points for the life safety and code condition categories. Whereas in the other districts, you see an average of 4.4 more points for planning and design, 2.9 more points for the quality of the cost estimate. And it makes sense that some of these districts would have higher quality cost estimates and higher quality planning and design, because they can actually go and do the project on their own through their own bonding and then come back and get reimbursement afterwards. If you're a municipal district, the REAs can't do that. They can't finance the project unless they get funding. And so the districts that are able to go on their own are going to be farther down the process. They're going to have higher quality cost estimates. They're going to have better planning and design because they're already doing the project. But that does mean that while the overall points are very close, potentially those other districts have worse quality schools but just lower quality projects because they're not as far in the process. Another parity issue here is that because the Department of Education can choose to apply REAA funds to major maintenance, the department can kind of stretch those dollars further down the list by using REAA funds. So you can have years where there's general funds that go to major maintenance, and this happened in FY26 and I think FY24, for example. The legislature provided UGF to those projects for the major maintenance list. And the Department of Education chose to use REAA funds for major maintenance projects so that they could go further down the list. And sometimes the legislature has picked funding amounts that suggests that Department of Education should do that. You know, the amount a couple of years ago was equal to an amount down the list, assuming the REAA fund filled some of the gaps. And last year was a different example. In FY26, the legislature funded the top three projects, two of which were REAA projects, and the GF was equal to those top three. But then the department chose to apply UGF to the top two so that you could get five projects done. And that sounds like a great idea because you can get more projects done that way. But the result of that, if that happens year after year, is that that marginal UGF never goes to REAA projects because those projects end up being funded entirely with the REAA projects fund, and then the UGF always goes to municipal districts. So that potentially increases the lack of parity in this program if the only way an REAA can get funded is through the REAA fund, which, as we said, already doesn't have enough money to meet the total school construction needs. And then anytime we put UGF, none of it goes to the REAAs. It all goes to municipal districts. That expands that or increases that parity issue that I think the committee was talking about beyond just the scoring alone. Just because of the way the fund works or the REAA fund works with the two lists potentially leads to a larger parity issue. I said a lot, so I'm going to pause for questions.
Senator Stedman.
So this year when we look at the list, we got, you know, one school that just showed up in number two position for $35 million, rounded off. Second highest out of all the $401 million in projects. There's another school that's 28th position at $54 million, and there's 103 schools on this list. So normally we'd pick a number and they'd fund right down the list, but if we assigned in individual appropriations these particular schools on this list, would that help in that issue of parity?
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, I think the potential issue is the reason that the legislature wanted to have these lists is to remove political factors in what projects get funded. And while there may be good reasons to skip down the list in one year, I think the purpose of the list is to try to avoid the political things, so maybe separate political from policy reasons to do that. So potentially it's setting a precedent for not following the list that could be used for other purposes in the future. I think that would be the concern, but it is a policy choice of the legislature to follow the list or not.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stedman.
As a follow-up. Yeah, I'm not so sure there wasn't a little dose of politics to get into number two position to start with. That's the concern. We've asked the department to give us the age of these projects, how many years they've been on the list. And my understanding of the statutes is the commissioner of education has the ability to deviate and modify the recommendations from the board that recommends this list. And we've asked her to bring forward to the committee her list. Now, I don't know if we're going to see that or not. I will be surprised if her superiors don't truncate that, but I think that would be beneficial because my concern with the list is some of the more sophisticated schools as far as preparation and quality of estimates put some of the other schools at a disadvantage that have higher health safety issues than the schools that are polished up on their ranking. And, you know, it's when you have schools that have mold infestations, black mold infestations in their duct systems and, you know, some leaky roofs and some other things, and they've been on for years, I think we should take a look at that and at least understand how this list is and decide collectively if we want to deviate with it or not. But I would agree with you. We have these lists to keep politics out of it. But my concern, politics has corked us on this list. So we'll, I guess that is, we'll work that issue out, Mr. Chairman, as we go forward.
And we had meetings with the Commissioner of Education. She noticed and told us that there are flaws in the system. Unless they are addressed, I think that we are, because of the disparities that you have pointed out, we are inviting Casile 2.0, which will force us to address the issue. And I think that we as a body should work with the administration, try to come up with something that is that makes brings more parity back to the process. I don't know if that's going to be able to be accomplished, but I would sure like to see if we could come up with something. Senator Stedman.
Just as a reminder, Mr. Chairman, as I recall, the committee has asked the Commissioner of our Commissioner of Education to come forward with recommendations on modifying that process.
We have. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Painter, I am sort of struggling, thinking my way through your last bullet. And what gives me pause initially is that the money into the REAA fund we're talking about here is UGF as well, is it not?
Senator Keel, through the chair, yes.
So I guess on first blush, when I read this, my reaction is that assume we have a validly developed list that really is the priority list and doesn't have any other considerations in it. Shouldn't we be blind to the ultimate source of, or rather, I guess, why would it matter to us that that some of the funds from are direct UGF to the list and some of the funds are indirect UGF to the list? We're just funding the list in priority order.
Through the chair, Senator Keel, so the purpose of the REA fund was to establish parity with the school major the school debt reimbursement program. So the state is putting money to that and then puts a corresponding amount into the REA fund. So you're achieving parity between that program and then school construction and major maintenance there. But then if there's additional money that goes into school construction and major maintenance, if the added UGF, the marginal UGF added there, only goes to urban districts, then we've lost the parity that you get between the two other programs, if that makes sense. So the REA funds are going in there to make up for school debt, only impacting municipal districts. And so just those two programs alone theoretically have parity, but because you can also put UGF into the other program, if that means that it only goes to urban districts or municipal districts, you end up with a disparity again.
Senator Keel.
That's helpful. Sometimes you have to spell it out in more smaller words for me. So that's useful. And I guess part of that issue then would be that municipalities can bond for whatever's qualified. They're not bound to a list. The state's share just goes on the debt service line. Is that what I'm getting?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, yes.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you.
And because of the urban districts are not bonding, the REAA fund is stymied and will result in, as it was explained, 5 years to fund the next school. The rest of the schools will slowly be deteriorating, and major maintenance in a flawed formula will not get addressed, and those schools will start to crumble and will fall into the school construction list. And the school construction list does not get addressed, and thereby, in default, we are inviting Casile 2.0, which the courts will force us to address. Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd just like to remind the committee that all this work between urban and rurals does not include Mount Edgecombe High School. There's the third wheel out there that has a whole other set of issues trying to be on a list. And we'll bring, Mr. Chairman, if I could, we'll bring Mount Edgecombe's maintenance list forward here in the next week or so, a couple weeks, along with the museums that are also under deed. Because the concern there is they may be as ignored as Edgecombe with indeed. Because I don't recall the Department of Education ever coming in and advocating for anything for museums and or Edgecombe without us pulling them in.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. Please proceed.
I've got Kleenex here for myself.
All right, Mr. Chairman, so the next slide kind of looks at the two kind of parallel paths, I suppose, from the municipal standpoint, and then the following slides from the state standpoint. So for a municipality, the school major maintenance program has a couple of advantages compared to school debt reimbursement. So you get the lower cost share. Instead of paying, anywhere from 50 to 60%, you're paying 35% max. And then the state share is provided up front. So if you manage to get funded, you get all the money for sure. The disadvantage is that program, you can never be sure that you're going to get funded from year to year. So the districts that do go out on their own and bond and go back to this program, they may never get reimbursement because there's no funding formula and funding comes in every few years pretty irregularly. The school debt reimbursement program theoretically is a trade-off of a lower reimbursement rate in order for higher certainty. So, we make these appropriations every year, except that the legislature has only partially or not at all funded school debt payments in 5 of the last 10 years. So half the time you don't get the full amount. And so that impacts your certainty, which is an issue for the school district or the municipality in part because they've already contracted this debt. They have debt payments that are outstanding, and then the state, if they choose not to make the payment, the local government has to come up with the money. So often they have to raise taxes, use their fund balance. That's especially an issue for districts or municipalities that have a tax cap, so they can't just raise taxes as easily because it may be hard for them to go back and get the money once they've already set their mill rate, for example. So it can put them in a difficult situation. And so I think the school debt program may lose some of its appeal to districts because of the history of partial funding over the past decade. From the state standpoint, one of the advantages of, when you partially fund school debt reimbursement, it shifts the cost to local taxpayers. Whereas when you fund less school major maintenance, it results in no projects going forward. That can be a plus or minus, right? It's maybe bad for your constituents if they pay higher taxes, but on the other hand, at least the projects still happen. Whereas major maintenance, if no projects happen, that can create issues as well. In a year with high revenue, if you fund major maintenance, you can go farther down the list. But that inconsistent funding means that districts have it's very difficult for them to count on that program and to choose to get on the list. We've heard anecdotally about districts that have chosen not to really put a lot of effort into the major maintenance and school construction list because it's a lot of effort for very uncertain reward because the funding is so inconsistent. And just generally, that funding level is clearly insufficient to meet the need. And, if you look at that $12.5 billion of insured school facilities, 1% of that value would be $125 million. The state has not met that 1% since, I believe, FY15. I don't have that in front of me. Maybe FY14. So it's been a long time since we've met even that need on an ongoing basis. And so because districts are not utilizing school major or school debt because of the course of the moratorium, but we don't know how much they will going forward, there's just not enough money going into the system to meet the ongoing needs going forward. And that is my last slide. Happy to answer any other questions the committee may have.
Questions of Mr. Painter? Thank you for bringing more problems to the finance table. That concludes the meeting today. Our next meeting will be tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. We have three items on the agenda: complex care residential homes, Senate Bill 76, fishery product development tax credit, Senate Bill 130, SJR 29, constitutional amendment for education. With that, we are adjourned.